And we are on the air, and you are listening to the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show. Let's talk. And I am Hallie Kesser-Jane. Welcome to my listeners in the United States and around the world. The Hallie Kesser-Jane Show is always available online at HallieKesserJane.com. Today we begin with journalist and author Jonathan Chait, whose new book, Audacity, is the talk of the town. And in the second half hour, a revisit with former Prime Minister David Cameron's senior advisor, Steve Hilton, the author of More Human. So let's get to it. Jonathan Chait is a political columnist for New York Magazine. Previously a senior editor at The New Republic, he has also written for the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and The Atlantic. He's been featured throughout the media, including appearances on NPR, MSNBC, Fox News, CNN, HBO, The Colbert Report, Talk of the Nation, C-SPAN, Hardball, he's everywhere, and on talk radio in every major city in America. Jonathan Chait comes to the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show to talk about his brand new book, Audacity, How Barack Obama Defied His Critics and Created a Legacy That Will Prevail, in which he makes the argument that most of Obama's achievements will not only survive a Trump administration, but also the judgment of time, which will proclaim that Obama was among the greatest and most effective presidents in American history. Let's talk.
All right, let's just get right to it with you. Listen to me. The Republican story about President Obama is that in 8 years as president, he accomplished nothing, zero. And there are a lot of voters who seem to have bought the Republican assessment. Others say that the little that President Obama did accomplish in his 8 years as president wasn't worth a dime, or worse, hurt America. What does Jonathan Chait, the brilliant Jonathan Chait, say?
Well, I make the case in my book that he actually did a lot. He did a lot more than anybody recognizes, and that even his supporters, I think, have been disillusioned without really understanding how much change he was able to bring about during his presidency. So I try to explain all the things he did and why it was that we didn't see all the change he managed to accomplish.
So give us what is at the top of your list of the things that he did achieve.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, and I'm not going to bore people with a long list, but I'd say the major ones are preventing another Great Depression, which would have happened if it wasn't for all the things he did to stop it, not just the stimulus, but the bank rescue, the stress tests, which didn't spend any money but stopped the bank runs, and the auto bailout, which would have allowed the Midwest to fall into another depression if he hadn't stepped in and saved it. Then you have the Affordable Care Act. You have all the change in climate, the investments in green energy, and then the diplomacy with China, and then the Paris Climate Agreement, which was the culmination of the whole thing, completely changed climate policy in a historical way. You have Dodd-Frank, which regulated and transformed, changed the financial sector, dramatically reduced risk and the benefit of too big to fail and that whole problem. I think they took care of that with very tough regulations and consumer protections, raised taxes on the rich, cut them on the poor, education reform, you know, a lot of things that people just didn't pay attention to, but important change.
So why doesn't he get any respect?
It's a great question. I think there are a lot of reasons. Of course, the Republicans made the decision from the beginning that they would oppose everything he did. I also think liberals kind of fatalistically gave in to despair. I try to make the case that liberals always get depressed about Democratic presidents, and they say the same things about every single one. He's faint-hearted. He gave in too much to the other side. He's in the pocket of business. He won't speak out and articulate our values. We need a real, true progressive champion. They said about everyone going all the way, every Democrat going back to Roosevelt, they said the same thing. And sometimes it's right, but in this case, it wasn't right. So many Obama supporters, if you ask them, they'll say something like, well, it's Republicans' fault he didn't get anything done. But they're wrong. He got a lot done.
Okay, so listen to me. I hear all of that, but here's where I want to go with you on it. With this laudable list of accomplishments, don't we have to acknowledge that the voters, not necessarily Democratic, but Republican and Democratic voters, over the course of Obama's 8 years in office, voted out Dems, gave Republicans power at the state and local levels, and now have reclaimed the presidency with this reactionary figure, Donald Trump, and that's being kind to him, right? I mean, in audacity, your point is that Obama succeeded in changing America in major, but there seems to be with, you take that and there's a disconnect. Help me out here.
There is, but it's strange to me that people are talking about this election as if Obama lost. Donald Trump didn't beat Obama. The 22nd Amendment beat Obama by preventing him from running again. But Obama, if you want to measure what people think about a politician, you don't look at what they said about some other politician. If you want to look at what people said about think about Obama, you don't look at what they think about Hillary Clinton. They clearly don't like Hillary Clinton. They think she's a crook. But they like Obama. He's at 60%. And so it's true that he left the Congress in Republican control, but the last five presidents all left Congress in opposing party hands. I think Democrats do need to do a better job of mobilizing for down-ballot races, and they've become increasingly dependent on a coalition of voters that don't show up at the polls as regularly as the Republican coalition does, which is older and wealthier. That's something they need to fix, and to some extent may be fixed over time as this young, heavily Democratic generation ages. But I don't think that's the right way to judge Obama. I think you have to judge how did he change policies. And I think these are deep changes, and I think a lot of them are going to be lasting and difficult to reverse.
Two things here. There's Obama, the man, and there's the Obama, the president, the politician. But, you know, they kind of overlap. Should we be looking at this in that respect?
I mostly try to focus on what he did, not who he is. It's not a history. It's not an autobiography. It's an argument about what did he do? Why did we miss it at the time? But it's impossible to miss his personal qualities, which played a huge role in the successes he managed to have. He's obviously very, very intelligent, very long-term minded, not distracted by whatever short-term thing has captured the attention of cable news at any given moment. He kind of disdains that immediate thinking and manages to keep his cool and make good, sound, long-term decisions. Sometimes he avoids risk, and sometimes he's willing to throw the dice. Like after Scott Brown won the Senate seat in Massachusetts in 2010, half the Democratic Party or more was throwing in the towel on health care reform, and it was just reported throughout the press as being dead. That's just a fact. It was over. And Obama didn't lose his heart. He didn't lose his cool like a lot of other people did. And he said, we've still got to pass this law. And he did it.
Let me bring this into you. The Obama legacy, yep, really any president's legacy, is surely measured over the long term rather than the short term. But in the short term, this is where we are. President Donald Trump, America, yep, the world is in onto a wild ride. Oh, my God. Act one, scene one of Trump's administration, appeal Obamacare. Act two, we know, build the wall, you know, and here we go. You know the drill. Here's where it's, yep, at. How does the legacy, the political legacy, survive that?
Let me make two points about that. Number one is we don't usually judge presidents by their successors. You ask most historians the greatest president in American history, they'll say Abraham Lincoln, right? Ask them who's the worst president in American history, most of them will say Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson came after Abraham Lincoln. In fact, Abraham Lincoln made him president by dumping his vice president and putting Andrew Johnson on the ticket to win his reelection. He set himself up for when he was assassinated to put one of the worst, probably the worst president in American history in the Oval Office. But no one says Lincoln's legacy is Andrew Johnson. You look at what Lincoln did. So Obamacare, I think people are fatalistically concluding that this law is going to be toast just because Trump says he's going to get rid of it. He does say that, but he also says he's not going to leave people in the lurch. He's not going to take it away and give them something that's better and cheaper as a replacement. Well, he's not going to be able to do that because it's not really possible to do a plan like that. Republicans would have written that plan if it was possible sometime over the last 8 years to do it. So he's making a lot of promises he can't make, and Republicans are clearly afraid of destroying the system that Obama's law built. So this is really a time bomb that's going to blow up the Republican Party's control of government, and they need a way to finesse it. I think it's much more likely that they'll just try to get Democrats to agree to some small cosmetic changes to this law, call it replace, and leave most of the successes in place rather than take the risk of creating a disaster that could end their control of government.
Interesting, because, you know, where I want to go with you is on the word propaganda. And maybe that's a strong word. You may come up with a better one than I did. In this country, it's now become an art. both parties have mastered it, how to control the dialogue, the masses, formulate image, play the press, wage war against one or another, right? It's there, Jonathan. And even what's going on right now is part of that propaganda. You know, both sides are playing the game. And us, you know, we poor voters, you know, we're kind of lost in it. But I'll get to that in a second. But here's something that you do say. Many of our voters don't even realize the scope and breadth of the power of the center's ability to manipulate them. That's what I say. But what is that in mind? You assert that the myth has a clear purpose. You're actually said, and I think this was brilliant on your part, that the myth of Obama's repudiation is not just to repudiate him. It actually has a very clear purpose. What's the propaganda?
Right. It has the purpose. They want to make people think that this election was a repudiation of Obama so that we all think it's natural and fair that the Republicans can come in and just undo all his legacy. So that's what people voted for. That's what they get. So that we don't notice the fact that, well, Obama's at 60%. Trump's in the 30s. So maybe people didn't really vote with this election with the purpose of getting rid of everything Obama did or to enact Trump's ideas, but rather they had a lot of personal disdain for Hillary Clinton that Trump was able to exploit.
That to me is one of the most interesting points that you make in the book, by the way.
Thank you very much.
I seriously, that's just something, you know, I hadn't thought about. And as we look on his legacy today, what do you see as the worst that he leaves behind? Let's be fair. Let's see both sides.
I think he had some failures in foreign policy that you have to acknowledge. I think they didn't get a handle on the Arab Spring. They didn't know what to do in Syria. The refugee crisis, which is helping to destabilize Europe as well. So I wrote this book not to be Obama's lawyer and defend everything he did, but to make a clear assessment of his successes and his failures. And I come out saying he had a lot of success, a lot more than you realize, but he did some things wrong. And I think in foreign policy is where you find a much more mixed bag than in domestic policy, which is a real record of success.
Compare it to FDR.
Well, no one compares to FDR domestically. On the other hand, FDR did a lot of things wrong. He interned the Japanese Americans. He decided to reverse his fiscal policy in 1937 and cut the deficit, and he created another recession in the middle of the war. He had to make some terrible compromises because Southern Democrats were important to him. He had to design Social Security and a lot of these programs to exclude African Americans, although they later came into the programs. So FDR was hardly an unabridged hero, someone who did everything right, but he did a lot of huge things. And so no one is going to have that effect because FDR essentially invented the idea of the federal government having major responsibility for helping Americans. No one's going to reinvent something that's already been invented.
Can we speak in this conversation without speaking of Obama and race relations and that legacy?
No, that my first chapter is about race. I think it's a chapter I'm very proud of. I think it's a very nuanced, complex story. And race was central to how people thought about Obama. He deeply impacted people on all sides of it and created, it drove a lot of the response to him. It drove a lot of the support for him. I think I try to tell the story where race is not just something that happened to Obama, but something that he managed to control. At first, he was, I think, leery and defensive about being seen as being seen by white America as just an advocate for black America, and got caught off his guard a couple times. But I think he managed to take control of the story in a way that's going to really last. I think what he did was to talk about the African American struggle for freedom as being not only central to, but the epitome of the American idea. That America was about bringing more closely into alignment America's founding ideals with its reality. The reality never matched the ideals, and race was the way in which it was most distant from its ideals. And the American story, as Obama tells it, is of getting ever closer over time, not always in one direction, but in fits and starts, getting closer and closer, step by step, toward bringing those ideals into reality. And race is the ultimate example of that. So he's made that struggle the very essence of America, which is a really fascinating and radical way to talk about America and its history. But I think it's true, and I think it's going to last.
very, very quickly on this, as far as Obama is concerned, how does you think he's feeling that the legacy that he's leaving is goes to somebody like Trump for a while?
Yeah.
Sickening.
Well, no, I mean, I think everyone was sick. You know, Obama is a very level person. He just does not change day to day very much. Even in the face of huge events, he's always able to see the long term. So I don't think he's like an emotional wreck. He's clearly not happy with it, I think, but I think he's in strategy mode of what can I do to get the best long term outcome for this country. I think he's totally honest when he says he believes in the long run we'll get past this. I think he's prepared to defend democratic institutions if Trump starts doing dangerous autocratic things. I think he's willing to speak out. And as a popular leader, I think he has a lot of legitimacy to push back if he's needed to take that role.
Hey, Jonathan, great book. First one out, the new season. Thanks a lot.
Yes, thank you so much for the interview. I really appreciate it.
I've been speaking with Jonathan Shait, the author of an important new book, Audacity, How Barack Obama Defied His Critics and Created a Legacy That Will Prevail. You can read Jonathan's incisive pieces in New York Magazine. Follow Jonathan Shait on Twitter at Jonathan Shait. You are listening to The Hallie Kasserjain Show. My guests today are Jonathan Shait, author of Audacity, How Barack Obama Defied His Critics and Created a Legacy That Will Prevail, and Steve Hilton, author of More Human, Designing a World Where People Come First. From the left, from the right, we have it all on The Hallie Kasserjain Show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Steve Hilton has been called many things. One, the Steve Jobs of politics. Hilton, the t-shirt-clad guy, is one of the UK's most known political figures, probably only behind David Cameron and Boris Johnson. As Prime Minister Cameron's senior advisor, he literally remade the Tory party into a modern, winning, conservative party after decades in exile. Now Hilton has his eyes set on America's political system. He is out with a brand new book, More Human, Designing a World Where People Come First. He says that government, business, the lives we lead, the food we eat, the way our children are brought up, the way we relate to the natural world around us, it's all become too big and distant and industrialized. Inhuman. It's time to do something about it. It's time to put people first. It's time to make the world more human. Hilton is also the co-founder and CEO of CrowdPack, a Silicon Valley political, nonpartisan tech startup, and teaches at Stanford University. Let's talk.
All right, Steve, okay. It's the morning after. How exciting is this, old Mr. Political Guru? Surely you have some comments on Mr. Trump's win, extraordinary win. Talk to me.
I think it's really exciting because it shows that one of the main arguments I've been making and write about in my book, More Human, is that for many, many years now, for decades, the systems and the structures that we've built to run the modern world have just become taken over by a kind of technocratic agenda run by bankers and bureaucrats and accountants that have been pushing globalization and technological change at any cost and favoring big business over small business and prioritizing efficiency over everything else and forgetting the impact of all that on real people, on real working people in their lives. And you're seeing what the Trump success shows is that people are sick of all of that. And they're really in revolt against all of that. Now, that is not to say that I necessarily agree with everything he's saying or all his positions, but I'm thrilled that what he's done is shine a spotlight on the way the world has been going and the big changes I think we need to make the world more human.
I have to ask you this. How come the party missed it? How come the press missed it? Everybody missed how angry people were. What's your take on that?
I think that this sounds like a bit of a cliche, but I think it's because they genuinely are out of touch. They live different lives to the people who are, you know, who are suffering, have been suffering the consequences of the agenda that they have been united behind. And when I say united behind, what I mean is that actually it has made very little difference whether Republicans have been in charge or Democrats have been in charge. You've had the same kind of agenda promoted about, and also in the private sector, in the way that companies behave. And it's made really very little difference to people who's been in charge. And that's why they've been so angry, because it seems as if it doesn't matter who you vote for, doesn't matter what you do, we get the same old stuff. And basically the elites just keep telling us we have to suck it up. This is the modern world. Just got to go with it. And they've had enough. And I think that the reason that everyone missed it was because the people that you're describing have not had to suffer those realities. They are literally living in a different world. And that's why they just didn't understand the depth of anger that I think has been there for many, many years.
It's fascinating. Now, listen, about this book, More Human, Designing a World Where People Come First. Well, now there's a novel idea, Steve. People come first. I mean, talk to me. How come you're the one who finally put the finger on the pulse of what needs to be changing here?
Well, I don't know about that, about finally. I mean, this is the what I write about in my book is very much what I've been arguing in politics and policy terms for many, many years now, including back in the UK. I live out in California now and have been there for 4 years, but prior to that I was in the British government working for Prime Minister David Cameron, and the agenda that we were trying to advance there was very much about some of the things I talk about in More Human, in terms of trying to dismantle some of these structures that have put decisions further and further away from people, so they have this sense that the things that affect their lives are decided by distant bureaucrats or CEOs or whatever who don't understand their lives. In government in the UK, we did try to change some of that and put power back into people's hands by, for example, giving people control over zoning decisions in their neighborhood, or trying to dismantle some of the centralization that affected the British government. You know, in various ways we tried to do this, but I wouldn't say at all that we did a perfect job. In fact, I was very frustrated at the fact that we didn't achieve many of the things I wanted to do. And that's in a sense why I wanted to write this book, to say, well, look, if I had a free hand, if I could design the perfect world, the perfect way we would run schools and healthcare, the way we would get our food, the way we would run government, what would that look like? And that's the picture I've tried to paint in this book, More Human. It's a kind of ideal version of a world where people really are in control of the things that matter to them.
I have to ask you this, these enormous structures that are built within government and in the food industry, and you take everybody on in this wonderful book of yours, but was it sinister, or was it just, it was the time and that looked like the answer, or what? I mean, is it sinister? Was it sinister? Which would make it tougher to deconstruct?
No, I don't think it's that. I don't think that the people involved have bad intentions. And I'm really at pains to say that in the book, that the people that I encountered working in government, the senior civil servants and people in business, I think they all think they're doing the right thing. They all mean well most of the time, and they're highly professional and smart, decent people. And in a sense, I make this point in the introduction. It's the fact that over the years, the systems themselves have become so big and bureaucratic. They actually make people behave in ways that wouldn't behave if they were just able to be human. One of the story that I tell at the beginning of the very first story in the book, the very personal human story about a mother traveling on JetBlue with her two children, who ends up being treated in an appalling fashion by the flight attendant on a JetBlue flight. And if you take a step back from the story there, you would say to yourself, nobody would treat a mother with her child like that in normal life. That flight attendant wasn't a sinister or ill-intentioned person. It's just that the systems that have grown up, the airline policies, the federal aviation guidelines and all this kind of stuff, all these layers and layers of bureaucracy, they end up forcing people to behave in inhuman ways. And I think that is true right across the board in government and the economy. And that is the fundamental reason I think people are so frustrated and angry. And so the real answer, I think, is not just to change the face at the top or change a few policies here and there. It is actually to really dismantle these structures that have built up over decades and make things work on a more human level.
You know, when you're telling the story about JetBlue, and you could do that with calling Comcast or calling any of these corporations
exactly,
to get help.
Exactly.
And it's as if people don't think anymore. There's no thinking. There's just, here's the A, B, C, D list I'm supposed to follow.
I totally agree. Exactly. It is literally in you. And I find myself all the time, I'm sure many people listening would the same, was like, why can't you just talk to me like a human being? Why can't you just stop being this robot? And of course, it's not their fault. they're told to do that. They're not bad people. When they leave their jobs, they're regular, lovely, charming people like everyone. But when they get in these positions, they have to follow these rules and these structures, and that's what drives everyone crazy, including the people doing it, I think. They don't want to have to behave like that. They don't like the fact that they have to treat people so badly.
You're kinder than I. You're kinder than I. But listen to me about this. If you were to deconstruct these huge, bureaucratic structures, if you will, that have been put into place, then you get into something else I wanted to talk to you about, and that's the power equation. You know, I always think this, that we are up against that. You know, if you take away the structure, you take away maybe the control of power, and people who are in these positions are people who adore power. Are we not up against that?
Yes, 100%. That is exactly why it's so difficult. But that's exactly why we have to be honest about that and confront that, and understand that that's the only way that anything's going to change. So let's get specific about it. In terms of the corporations in the private sector, it really does mean breaking up these giant corporations that have emerged. Because what you're seeing in America today is, in almost every sector, a massive concentration of economic power. That is very un-American. It is not in keeping with the spirit of American capitalism and free enterprise, which is all about fair competition. And we don't have that anymore in nearly every sector. And so that we have to have a massively more aggressive and tough antitrust policy. And it starts by breaking up these companies, not just the banks that we hear about the whole time, but the airlines and the telecom companies and the health insurance companies and the giant food and agriculture businesses. The reason that they can become so dehumanized is precisely as you just said, they can abuse their power. And in the end, the term I use in More Human to describe these companies is that they're barely businesses at all. They're really private sector bureaucracies. They're practically like an arm of the government, in the sense that the way that they operate and the way they see their success is not necessarily just competing in the marketplace, but actually using lawyers and lobbyists to influence the rules to their advantage, to keep competitors out and to entrench their power. And so there's only one way to deal with that, is literally to break them up and then to have much tougher rules to stop them accumulating so much power in the marketplace that they can abuse it. And so we got to do that right across the board. It's really, really hard because they have captured the levers of power in Washington, D.C. They have got their teeth into all the legislators. This is why Trump, going back to your earlier question, this is why he has a real appeal, because he called that out. He says that's what's going on, as he puts it. Why is healthcare such a disaster? Because the big insurance companies take care of, in his words, the legislators. That's true.
Oh, yes, it is. And that brings to mind two thoughts. Let's talk money first, because money is one of the big issues here. There's so much money in the politics and the lobbyists, and, you know, they've just completely screwed up the game for the little guy. How do you get that fixed?
Yeah, that is absolutely right. I think that you've got it brings me to my day job, really, which is running this business called CrowdPack out in California. It's a tech startup focused on politics, and specifically it's a crowdfunding site for politics. And the reason that I started it was that I, looking at this terrible problem of big money in politics, and remember, it's not just from big businesses, it's just as much a problem on the other side with the way that the unions, the public sector unions in particular, completely control policy on the left, and that doesn't operate in the public interest either. For example, it stops the kind of innovation you want to see in the way schools are run and provided. So it's a cross-party problem, the money in politics. Now, the reason that when I took a look at what was going on, it seems to me that you've got all these different people and organizations campaigning for change, for getting money out of politics or changing the rules. And it seems to me that it's very hard to see how any of them are going to be successful, because there's no consensus around a solution. So what I thought we might usefully do is actually try and approach it a different way and achieve change through the marketplace. And so I've started this company, CrowdPack, as a crowdfunding site for politics. So the idea is that we can make it much easier for citizens to find and fund candidates that support, that kind of match their beliefs, and try and, in a sense, dilute the power of the big money, bring more small donors in, do for every race, not just the presidential race, a little bit like what Bernie Sanders has been doing, get more small donors in and thereby make the, like, dilute the influence and the power of the big donors. That's the idea behind CrowdPAC. And so that's my way of trying to do something about it.
I love CrowdPAC, and I love the concept of the people then get to do what they want to do and get control over it. And they could. I mean, Bernie Sanders, and I guess Barack Obama even proved it, that, you know.
That's exactly right, yeah. The truth is that that's the one race. That's one race out of, you know, whatever, 400,000 that go on in America. And so if you really look at the corrupting power of money in politics, it's actually not at the presidential level. It's lower than that. It's certainly Congress, but even in a way, even more so state legislatures.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you actually look at the policy decisions that really affect people's lives on a daily basis, a huge chunk of them happen at the state legislative level. And there's very little scrutiny of what goes on there. You've got local media closing down. People don't know their state representative. They don't follow what goes on. And it's just, and it's literally been just completely bought by big money interests on the left and the right.
Right. Yeah, I'd love to go there with you, and I will for a second, because I actually bring this up in the second interview that's on the show today. And I say that there is no local anymore in America. That's a problem. We don't have local newspapers that are telling people what's going on. We don't have local stations. Radio stations now are, you know, owned by Clear Channel and the big people, and so they're running, you know, national shows rather than what's happening on the local level. I do think that has a lot to do with a lot of the problems that are going on.
Yes.
You know,
I really agree with that.
Yeah,
I think that's absolutely right.
And that's something that has to be fixed. The other thing that I wanted to get to you with is, okay, so we're going to do this, and I love your concept, and I'm with you all the way on this, but then you're up against this. What do you do with these CEOs? What, off with their heads? I mean, they're not going to give up their structure, so what are we going to do?
No, they're going to fight, but you've got to, you know, I remember being around in the UK when Margaret Thatcher started taking on, not just, the, I mean, she's famous for taking on the entrenched power of the union bosses. And that was a big, big fight that she, that was very brutal, but she had to, but also that there was the CEOs then. There, it's very interesting. People don't remember this, but there was, there's an organization called the CBI, the Confederation of British Industry, and it represented all the establishment CEOs in the UK. And they were absolutely hostile to what Mrs. Thatcher was doing to reform the British economy, because she was taking on their power as well. And she was a conservative prime minister. In fact, I remember there's a famous phrase that the head of the CEO's organization, the CBI, said that they would have a bare knuckle fight with Mrs. Thatcher over her reforms to the British economy. And in the end, they had the fight and she won. And honestly, there is no substitute for incredibly strong political leadership to take on and win these battles. That's the only way that anything ever happens. And in a sense, what I'm trying to do with this book is set the table for that and set out an agenda for change that hopefully political leaders will take up and then battle for, and I hope to play my own part in that somehow in the years ahead.
I have to ask you this, Steve. You've been around this business for business, and I call it, now it's a business. Politics has become a business, and it used to be that the people who, you know, ran for office, you know, were not business politicians. They were people who cared. Do you feel that there's the same people are manning the ship or going for the office today, or do we have a different kind of person running, a more narcissistic?
It's a really great question, and I think that is a big part of the problem, because people now are running for office who are very comfortable with the system, and they know how to play the game, and they are part of the system. And so there's a lot of evidence now that you have, you know, former, you know, people who worked in Congress as aides then run for Congress themselves, and they're very familiar. They're kind of recycling the same old people within the system-based people. And I think that's a really big problem, and that's why one of the other aspects of CrowdPAC that I really care about and hope will have an impact is the way that we want to make it easier for independent and independent-minded candidates to run for office, because you have a lot of people who feel that they can make a contribution, that they don't like the way things are going in their community or at the state level or even at the national level. They want to run for office, but they think, you know what, I'm not a kind of dyed-in-the-wool Republican, I'm not a Democrat, I'm not independently wealthy like Trump or Bloomberg, I can't get involved in politics because you've got to raise money. And to raise money, if you're a Republican, you have to go along with all the business stuff. And if you're a Democrat, you have to go along with the union stuff. And I don't really agree with that. I'm not going to bother. And what we've built at CrowdPack is a very simple tool for anyone to run for office just by, literally, it's like crowdfunding, like a Kickstarter campaign where you can say, I'm interested in running for city council or state legislator, whatever it may be. And you can create a pledge campaign, which you can send out to your friends and your network of people and say, look, I'm thinking of running. Would you support me? And people can pledge money to you, and their card will only be charged if you actually enter the race. So it's a great way of people taking that first step into politics. And before going through all the hassle of setting up a fundraising committee and all the compliance stuff that's around that, they can quickly test the waters and get that confidence to know that there is support for them out there. And we're already seeing at the local level people who never would have thought of getting into politics actually running for office and winning. You know, we just had a great in Pennsylvania at the State House. We had a candidate who complete outsider was nominated by, I think, as a teacher, was nominated by his students to run for office and actually ended up winning just now, the other week, and funded his campaign on CrowdPack. So that is a small step forward and a small sign. But as we grow, I hope that one of the things that we'll be able to achieve through CrowdPack is opening up the system so you get fresh faces into politics who are not captured by the same old big party machine.
You're so innovative. This is why I love you, why I wanted to talk to you. I've watched your career. I've watched what you've done. You're the exception to the rule, my friend. And to break through the noise with innovation these days is very tough. People like the tried and the true. The same thing with Donald Trump. I mean, they got to tear him down. Now, whether we agree with him and his tactics even, that's a different issue. But if you look at somebody like Trump, who is somewhat innovative, right, in his thinking, you see how the system responds. It goes into chaos. That's what we're up against. So even if you take your deconstructing the big, monolithic, ridiculous size corporations, chaos. Will chaos reign? Does chaos reign when we let go of the tried and the true and we go for the more innovative concepts?
I don't think it's chaos. I think that it's just, I think people, you know, in the end, I think you've got to have I have a view that people are very smart and sensible. And if you let them make more decisions, you get better outcomes. And I sort of trust people to do the right thing. And that sounds like a simplistic kind of cliche, but in the end, it's pretty fundamental. And that's been the genius of human progress for forever, really, is that we've been able to figure things out and work together. And I guess in the end, that is a kind of maybe a particularly kind of conservative viewpoint, which is that this faith in human nature and this ability of people to do the right thing and organize through family and community and entrepreneurs starting businesses and so on, without some master plan from a distant administrator. That is definitely what I believe. And therefore, I think that if you break things up and give people control and power, good things will happen.
I like your thinking. But there is this too. They're making the outsiders, the Bernie Sanders, the Donald Trumps, into the boogeyman now. And that's what I'm. That's the response from the establishment.
Nobody's listening to that. That's what's really interesting. In this whole debate about that's happened the last few days, there's been a bit of a discussion around whether the media themselves created Donald Trump and by giving him all this coverage and so on. Well, you know, the truth is that so much of the coverage has been negative. Highlighting all the things that people don't like about what he says, and people just ignore it. They think, oh, we're sick of all of you. Here's someone who's different and may just change things. And I think that if you talk to Donald Trump supporters and the people voting for him, I would say that a lot of them aren't even, they wouldn't say for sure that they know he's gonna do anything different, but they think at least he feels like he might. And we're certainly not going to get any change from these other people, so we might as well give him a chance. I think that's the attitude.
Well, I think that's the attitude of the people. I'm talking about the establishment. The establishment's coming down on him in every way possible that they can. Listen, I want to talk about the word soundbite. You know that word. That's a scary word. It's a scary word because it is the new member of political discourse. And in this day and age, can a politician live without that soundbite?
Trump is the master of soundbite. And let me say this. Soundbites, to me, are synonymous with the simplistic one-size-fits-all solution that you are so railing against. We have a problem now with this, you know, and it's both sides of the aisle, by the way, on the simplistic answer to people. Talk to me.
I think that the problem has been that it goes back to your earlier point about the professionalization of politics. And I think that the thing that people are sick of are these slick phrases that they know you can hear as they're spoken, that they've been crafted by experts to kind of make you agree with them and think that the person is saying what you want to hear. And that's, I think, I mean, to be honest, I think that is the sort of big contrast between, say, a candidate like Ted Cruz and Trump, is that Trump actually, he does speak in a very simple way and uses words and language that's very direct and very simple, but not simplistic. It's actually pretty, it's kind of the opposite. It's just, it's very authentic. It's not crafted. It's not kind of considered. It's just really simple and people can understand it first because it's simple, but also they get the feeling that it's authentic, that it's not actually the product of some sort of endless research process by marketing professionals. Whereas when you hear Cruz speak, I think that is the impression that people got. And that's where the soundbite culture, I think, is so damaging. People just hear this stuff and think, oh, I don't believe it. It's just the kind of stuff that's just been written for them. They don't really mean it.
I want to go back to one thing about this terrific book of yours, Inhuman. You make a very interesting point about Sanders throwing out education should be free. And you say that's actually against the concept that you're fomenting in this book. Talk to me about that before we go.
Well, I think that here's a couple of things.
Okay.
First of all, we've got to understand that in terms of what government can spend on things, there has to be a limit, right? In order to have a dynamic economy, you have to have a healthy balance between what the state takes from people and companies in the form of taxation and what it spends. And if you let that get out of whack, then it actually starts to hurt the economy, and you get into debt, and it harms job creation and job growth. And so you can't let there's a limit to what you can spend. So the next question is, how do you allocate those resources? How do you decide what the state, what government should spend money on? And I think that there's two things. First of all, there is, when you come to something, there's a sort of general point about higher education and college, which is that when you say that it should be free, as he is saying, in order to make that happen, you're actually going to end up giving money to families who are already paying for college and who could perfectly well afford to pay for college. And there's no problem. And the fees are not a barrier to those families going to college. You're actually, in other words, what you're really doing there is taking money from poor families and giving it to rich families, which I think is the opposite of the kind of fairness argument that Sanders is making. But there's a broader point here, which is that if you actually think about where do you get the best value for the money that government puts into things, I think that generally over the last many decades, actually, we've been getting the balance wrong, because actually all the evidence shows that in terms of the return on your investment, in terms of really helping transform people's lives and give them the best start in life, the most important period for education is not college, it's not high school, it's not even K through 12. It's actually before kids even get to school. It's the early years. It's the first few years of life. There's so much evidence now from neuroscience and other fields that the things that happen with children's brain development and character development when they're, you know, 1 year old, 2 year old, 3 year, before they even get to school, that's what really counts. And we really underinvest in that. And so what I argue for in More Human is a massive switch of emphasis. So actually, if we really care about giving every child the best start in life and the best chances through life, then we need to get much better support into families and children at an early age. And in fact, if anything, we should take government money away from college and put it into the early years, because that's where you're going to get a better return on investment.
Before I let you go, great guru that you are, Trump, Clinton, who wins?
It's so difficult, but I honestly would, if you made me choose today, I would put my money on Trump, because I feel like people are, there's a real desire for fundamental change, and he's the one that is offering that. Now, you may say, well, he's not really offering that. Where's the policy program? Where's the platform? It's just his character and so on. That's a fair criticism. But when you look at Hillary Clinton, that doesn't look like someone who represents change. And I think that's what people want. Now, having said that, there's a long few months of campaigning to go. And as we know, these are both tough competitors. And there's lots of mud to throw around on both sides. And who knows where all that will go. But I think that in terms of the mood of the country, feels like Trump is more in tune with that than Clinton right now.
Here's my answer to you, though you didn't ask. I'm going to give it. You want to know why I think Trump wins? The what? Title of your book, More Human.
Right.
I've been speaking with Steve Hilton, author of More Human, Designing a World Where People Come First, by way of Public Affairs, a member of the Perseus Group. For your copy of the book, visit Amazon.com. Thanks so much for tuning in to The Hallie Kasserjain Show, a production of RESEC, LLC. The Hallie Kasserjain Show posts new podcasts Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. Visit HallieKasserjain.com.